I've got to admit, it's not exactly a household word, you know, a common word. But it's something that's used a lot, really. That is pragmatism. And we're going to look at Exodus chapter 32, verses 1 through 6. And I think this is at least one example of that. It says here that... wait just a minute now. It says that when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down out of the mount, the people gathered themselves together unto Aaron and said unto him, Up, make us gods which shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we know not what is become of him. And Aaron said unto them, Break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, of your sons, and of your daughters, and bring them unto me. And all the people brake off the golden earrings which were in their ears, brought them unto Aaron. And he received them at their hand, and fashioned it with a graving tool, which he had made, a molten calf. And they said, These be thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. And when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made a proclamation and said, Tomorrow is a feast to the Lord. And they rose up early on the morrow and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to play, or to eat and to drink, and rose up to play. That's a pretty good example of pragmatism. The people liked what was done. They had no objection to this. And I don't see any objection from anyone. As a matter of fact, in the end of this, the one that objected, of course, was God. And Moses. Now, in a lot of ways and in a lot of venues, if you will, religious or otherwise, if something like this would be so overwhelmingly popular and accepted, well, that means it's a good thing. That's how it works. Same way, if something would turn out poorly, they decide, well, this was a bad thing. And anything that's connected with it, you know, that goes out. Same way with anything connected. If it's popular, that would be good. That's an idea, an example, excuse me, of pragmatism. Now, it's not, obviously, just based on this one example here in Exodus, it's not a successful way to determine right and wrong. But it's done all the time. Just so much. And so this isn't something that we think to ourselves is some kind of a pragmatism. Well, that's some kind of an ancient... Aztec ritual or something, you know, that has been around for, you know, several centuries. Oh no. Practice every day. Practice the religion a lot. And I think, too, sometimes in churches of Christ, this kind of finds its way in more than what we think. When we think about the definition of it, now this comes from Grolier's Encyclopedia. Pragmatism is a philosophical movement. This was also something that was very popular in the late 1800s. It holds that both the meaning and the truth of any idea are functions of its practical outcome. Well, that'd be true. Now, whether the outcome's good or bad, that would be true. And so this may work in a number of instances. It may work without a whole lot of problem, you know. For example, if you had something like a leaky faucet, And so you don't really know what the cause is for the leak. But you start out, you know, and the first thing that you do is, well, let's replace the washers. So you replace the washers and the leak stops. That means that you did the right thing. Well, that's an example of pragmatism. That might not always be it, but that's how it works. And sometimes it does work successfully. But not always does it work like this. But what it does, it allows the results to determine any validity to the process. It is inaccurate in determining right and wrong. And really, I mentioned to Mike a few moments ago, he's asked me what the lesson was going to be. He was thinking about a song. I don't know what kind of song he got for pragmatism, but anyway, I said, no, let's just go on. But I told him at the time, you know, pragmatism is more of a case of the end justifying the means. Now, we're familiar with that, but this is really honing things down here. We may use pragmatism more than we think in religion. Now, I'm talking about people in general, and us as well. Sometimes that happens. And we do this because we allow the results to rule. I don't think it's any stretch of the imagination that out here in the religious world, if there's a large crowd, then it must be right. Whatever's being done to bring the large crowd, it's right. There are churches in this area that are doing that very thing. Whatever it is, it's okay. And so what happens is there's too much focus on the results, and there's not very much on procedure. Whatever will bring this, well, that'll just be a great thing. And unfortunately, sometimes I think, it's been my experience, I think one of the biggest things that where we practice this, that board over there, the register board, or whatever you want to call it, I think sometimes, you know, that causes, you know, getting concerned about it contributes to the same problem. You know, we look at that and we think, well, you know, we want to get the numbers up. And if the numbers are up, well, how we got the numbers up, you know, that'd be a great thing. Whatever the numbers are, attendance or contribution. And if the numbers go down, everybody's, you know, gets worried about that and all that. And so we let that kind of rule the day. But now pragmatists will view things along this line and somewhat like this. They have a total focus on the results. That's all that matters. Nothing else does. Oh, we started out, there wasn't even a church here. Now we've got, you know, 150 people, whatever the number is, you know, manageable number, 150. And how'd you get all that done? And then they go through this and they talk about it, you know, well, we had this and that and the other. They start having a food pantry and that drew in a lot of people. And then they had this and they had, you know, and well, we tried having the, you know, like a VBS in the summertime because we've got a few children here. We had one. We didn't do very good. Boy, the next year we had a VBS and we had pony rides out in the parking lot. And wow, we had a whole bunch more kids. Well, that means that the pony rides are okay. That's how it goes, you know. And I used to say it down in Arkansas. Well, you know, we could get a whole lot more people here. All we've got to do is quit using the Bible so much. And then if we just set up tables out there in the parking lot and have two of the Southern favorites, which would be fried catfish or barbecue, we'd get a lot of people. And people would be, you know, deliriously happy with this kind of arrangement. But that's, again, that's pragmatism. It's the end, the number of people and so on, that count more than anything else. In Acts chapter 2, here's how a pragmatist would do this. In Acts chapter 2, after reading everything that happens there, on Pentecost, they'd see about 3,000 baptized, and a pragmatist would say, boy, that's really success right there. That's how they would determine it. Doesn't matter what was taught. Doesn't matter anything else. It's just they see the numbers. That's success. And on the other hand, you go to another case. You know, that was, I think that, you know, the greatest sermon in the Bible is the Sermon on the Mount. I think on the day of Pentecost, that particular sermon, I'd put that right up there with it. This is close to being the best outside the Sermon on the Mount that there is. You know, it's like you got 1A and 1B. And I got another one that I put right up there with those two, and that's Paul at Mars Hill in Acts chapter 17. I just think he does a wonderful job considering his audience and how he handled preaching to this particular audience. I think it was just a masterful job in a place that would have just been extremely difficult just to get anybody to listen to you when it came to the gospel. But then what happens at the end of this in Acts chapter 17? Well, the end of it you get in verse 34. And it says there were certain men that clave unto him and believed, and among the which was Dionysius the Areopagite, and a woman named Damaris, and others with them. Well, that does hardly seem like 3,000, does it? What would you say? I don't know. 25 or 30, something like that. Certainly a lot smaller number than on Pentecost. And the pragmatists would look at this there at Athens, where this is being, well, there's only a handful, and they'd say, oh, that was a failure. I don't know if I've got it anymore. I had a commentary that had that in there. You know, Paul's preaching at Athens was just unsuccessful. Why is it unsuccessful? Because the person that wrote that in that commentary was a pragmatist. That's why. Now, we shouldn't be judging these things like this. We ought to determine that this is the truth. And if the truth is preached right then and there, that's success. And if there would be one or 1,000 who would respond, that's a success too. You know, you could go on looking at some of the accounts in the book of Acts. You could go over to Acts chapter 19 when Paul's at Ephesus, and it tells you there that there are 12. Gives you a number, 12. And pragmatists look at that and say, well, that's just nothing. You know, there's another failure, you know. And so we don't need to get into that kind of thing. And we certainly don't get into the business of when you're thinking pragmatically about this, if the truth gets in the way of desired results, well, just forget the truth. Go with the results. Don't let that truth get in the way of things. I think that happens a lot, maybe a lot more than we care to consider or admit. But truth does not depend on results. Doesn't depend on does it work or not. That's not it whatsoever. Look at 1 Corinthians chapter 1. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, and we'll take a look at verses 22 and 23. And again, this is something I'm sure that's familiar to you, where Paul writes about the Jews and how they require a sign and the Greeks seek after wisdom. Not necessarily wrong in and of themselves, but that was all that they were doing, and they relied on that completely. But now watch verse 23. But we preach Christ crucified. And what happens when they preach Christ crucified is that these Jews find that a stumbling block and the Greeks foolishness. Well, now, you shouldn't do that because there's some people that get upset, they won't listen, and they're offended by that, and so on. All those things, okay. But you know what? It's the truth of this. And you continue to preach Christ crucified. Some won't have any part of it, some will. That's just kind of how it works. And we need to understand the results don't determine what happens over here. If you let the results determine this, then you'd say, well, it's a stumbling block and they count it foolishness. You know, stop that. Don't preach Christ crucified anymore. Really? Well, yeah, if you were going to be a pragmatist about the whole thing. And, you know, another thing that can be effective are lies and deception. There's a lot of that happens sometimes. It happens, and Jesus even warned about it. When you go to Matthew chapter 24, in Matthew chapter 24, verses 23 and 24, Jesus said, then if any man shall say unto you, lo, here is Christ, or there, believe it not. For there shall arise false Christs and false prophets, and show great signs and wonders, insomuch that, if it were possible, they shall deceive the very elect. Yeah. So this can be a problem. In 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 3 and 4, Paul talks about how the prince of this world, which would be the devil, has blinded the eyes of some so they can't see the gospel. Well, if you're all worried about pragmatism and the end and the results, and if the gospel gets in the way, get that out of here. And so people are deceived. Well, the gospel just gets in the way of us having, you know, great numbers and so on. And so they use this, and it's essentially blinding the eyes of folks. Maybe they may never hear the gospel. You ever turn on the TV? There are people on the TV that are preaching right now, you know, this at this time, the time that we live in. And they'll go through there, and one of the first things that they do is that they take this shot from the television shot from way back, so you can see the vast number of people that are there. It's just enormous how many in the building, and all the people that are there, 25, 30,000. And they'll say, well, that's just a regular thing. And then they start to pan down. You know, they come down with their focus until they get down to where the stage is at, and then there's the speaker. Be sharp looking, gregarious in behavior and so on, speech, glib, good talker. And he's going to talk for, say, 35 or 40 minutes. About right. Probably too long for some, but about right. And he'll start off with a passage of Scripture. And then he'll go on for the rest of his time and just completely lose sight of that passage and what it means. But it doesn't matter. Look at the number. Just look at it. And it's just a wonderful thing. And someone like this is just hailed, you know, as just the greatest thing in religion ever. Amazing, isn't it? Amazing. But they're deceived by this. Their eyes are blinded to the truth. They don't get a chance to see the truth. It's held from them. And another thing now, majority reaction is not a sure mark of validity. Now, you all know Matthew chapter 7, verse 13 and 14, where it says that there are few that choose the way to life. Talks about the narrow way, the broad way. Few choose the narrow way that leads to life. But the majority choose the broad way that leads to destruction. Many. Now, if numbers matter, if that's all that there is, then should we suggest that leading on to destruction is just some good and great thing? I don't think so. And Jesus didn't think so either. So what we've got to do, we've got to keep the proper perspective. We should never back away from what the instructions of Jesus were, even if they cause people to just turn their backs. The instructions of Jesus, I think we can boil it all down to Mark chapter 16, verses 15, 16. At first, he says, you go into the world and you preach the gospel to every creature. Now, in 2 Timothy, Paul writes about the same thing in preaching the gospel. He said, you preach it in season and out of season. Well, what's that mean? Well, the old-time preachers, all of them that I was ever familiar with, explained it this way. You preach it when they like to hear it, when they don't like to hear it. That's going to happen. Sure it is. Now, you're not doing it just to get people not to like it. But we can't go through here and just pick and choose out the good parts and go on all of that. And oh, everybody will really be happy. And maybe they'll eat and drink and rise up to play because everybody likes it. It's just fun. Really? Really? No, I don't think so. So we need to do that. And the second part of it is, he that believes and is baptized will be saved, and he that believes not shall be condemned. So that's the instructions of Jesus. They were good in the first century, and they're good today. They don't need to be honed down or anything like, oh, well, now, let's not, let's
Let's just make it easy for everybody. Let's leave that baptism out and just he that believes is saved. Or something along that line. And even then, you know, we've come to the point, I think sometimes, well, they've honed it down just to believing in faith, and then you begin to wonder, well, what's the belief and what's the faith? And you just can't imagine how watered down it becomes. Just acknowledging a supreme being sometimes. But that'll get big numbers. The less that's required gets big numbers. There's a principle in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 5 through 7. You know what it is, where Paul talks about himself and Apollos. And he says that there's one that plants, there's another one that waters. Different things are done by different folks. But then it's God who gives the increase. That's how it works. That's how it always works. It's not based on who's doing this, except when it comes to God giving the increase. I think that Paul's kind of downplaying what he and Apollos might have done there at Corinth. And truth is something that's permanent. Sanctify them through thy truth. Thy word is truth. It's not going to change. Jesus' word is truth, and it's permanent. It's not going to change. Now, I've already mentioned this. I'm going to go over it real quick one more time, that pragmatism abounds. There are churches, and unfortunately, there's churches of Christ. We had one down our way in Arkansas. And, I mean, they just changed completely. They got a man in there, and, oh, my goodness, I mean, he was really something. I went to a funeral one time. I met him on a couple of occasions, and I don't know. If I just say he was a real piece of work, I'll be nice, you know, and not say any more than that. Really something. I think he would have just come up with anything and done or said anything just for the sake of the numbers. Eventually, they dropped calling themselves a Church of Christ. He believed they all just call themselves a community church, because the idea of a church that's for the community, you know, people really like that. If we continue to call ourselves a Church of Christ, well, that'll just turn a lot of people off. If that's not pragmatism, I don't know what it is. And he was big on these programs and everything. It was all about the numbers and so on. And so what did they start to have? Well, they had marriage seminars. They had substance abuse counseling. These were all works of the church, by the way. Some of these things aren't wrong, but they're works of the church, you know, and they're to draw folks in. The building became almost just a meeting place for every kind of a counseling session or whatever was going on. They offered raft trips. I can't remember the name of the river, but they offered raft trips. That was a big thing. They camped as well on the raft trips. That was huge. They had a fall festival. They had a youth retreat. Had all these things. I remember when we were in Cincinnati. It wasn't a Church of Christ, but around the corner from us was a Catholic school that had a Catholic church that had a school. And they had a fall festival. And the fall festival, they had a beer garden. The church has a beer garden. Yeah, right in the parking lot between the school and the church building. And then the town let them use the ball field. And at the ball field, they had every night for about three nights, they had Las Vegas nights. Had the roulette table, the big wheel spinning, so on. I remember driving past there and I thought, that, you know, it's gambling. That's illegal in Ohio. And I was working for the police department at the time. I finally asked somebody, how do they get away with that? And the answer was, oh, well, it's a church. I thought, well, there we go. You know, I thought they were being honest about it. Instead, just overlook it, you know. And it's for a good thing. That's pragmatism too, by the way. And also, I can remember when they closed down, they'd stack all the you know, big aluminum beer containers, the kegs, out by the fence so they could be picked up by the truck wherever these things came from. And I countered them one time. I just drove along real slow. Yeah, I drive slow anyway. I drove along real slow. and the stack up against the fence. I think there was 32 of them in that stack. And there's another stack right behind it. That's a lot of deer. Of course, that's not a problem, is it? No, well, see, it's for the church. So, okay. Anyway, so, you know, you draw in a crowd. Sometimes they say, we say this. This is where a lot of our brethren do it. We'll draw in a crowd and then we'll teach them. I can remember, not necessarily our brethren, but when we were in a Christian church, that's what I used to hear about things when we did stuff, to draw a lot of people in the town. Well, we'll get them in here and then we'll teach them. Well, we got them in, but I don't ever remember teaching them after that. Good idea, maybe, if you're a pragmatist, but it never materialized. But the hard truth of all this, when you look at all this stuff now, the hard truth of it, if they have come for the programs, they have come for the gospel, they're not going to be interested in the teaching. That's what they come for. Mentioned John chapter 6 this morning. We're going to go over there for the balance of the lesson. Just look at a few things. We're not going to read it all. But we are kind of starting up there at the very beginning of John chapter 6. In verses 1 through 14. Jesus here and the disciples with him, they go through the process of feeding over 5,000 with 5 barley loaves and 2 small fish. That's really something. And then when you get to verse 15, the people are pretty well pleased with this, because Jesus perceived that they would come and take him by force to make him a king. What do you think was on their mind? Boy, if this guy could feed us like this out of that little bit, we'll make him king and let him do it all the time. But he wouldn't let that happen. He departed again into a mountain himself alone. Well, that's not how it's supposed to be. And what happens is that Jesus crosses over to the other side to Capernaum, and the people follow after him. They followed him in ships. I think a lot of them probably walked. And that was no small thing. They had to walk up the mountains and down on one side of the sea or the Jordan River. Then when they got to the other side, they had to go up that mountainside over there and down the other side to get over there where Jesus was at. It was some effort expended to get to where he was at. But he could feed them, couldn't he? And so Jesus had the multitude there. And like some people say, well, draw them out, then we'll teach them. And so verse 22 through 65, I think that you see that kind of thing happening. But Jesus was not a pragmatist, he was a realist. And he says in verse 26, verily, verily, I say unto you, you seek me, not because you saw the miracles, but because you did eat of the loaves and were filled. Well, they were there for the loaves. He knows that. He points that out. Oh, don't say that, Jesus. You'll offend some of them and they'll leave. Really? Really? But he tells them that all that notwithstanding, he says that they ought to seek the bread. Let me catch up here. They ought to seek the bread that comes from heaven. In verse 33, it's exactly what he says. The bread of God is he which cometh down from heaven and giveth life unto the world. That's the bread. You remember what Jesus said in one of his temptations? Man does not live by bread alone. Did these folks need to hear that, to learn that? Yeah. Sometimes we do too. That's right. It is all about the gospel. It's not about these other things. The gospel, that's what it's all about. He says in verse 41, I am the bread which came down from heaven. That's me that I've been telling you about. And then what else? In verse 63, he says that it is the Spirit that quickeneth or gives life. The flesh profits nothing. The words that I speak unto you, they are spirit and they are life. Now, it's not said in there, but you know what the idea is. You can eat this bread. I could give you more bread today, right now, and you'll be hungry again. But if you eat the bread that comes down from heaven, it'll satisfy your hunger. He also calls himself the water, living water, a water that will quench. You go over to that well, he said, drink out of that, you'll thirst again. But not with the water I give. There you go. Not a pragmatist, but real. Something real that you can get a hold of, that you can keep, that won't just go away after just a few hours. I think we understand that. But then we know what happens toward the end. You look down at verse 66. From that time, many of his disciples went back, and they didn't walk with him anymore. Well, no more bread, no more people. And Jesus even asked the 12, are you like that? Will you also go away? And thank goodness we've got this answer here from Peter. To whom else shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. They recognize the real thing. Not pragmatists. Realists. Listening to the greatest realist ever and latching hold onto what he said. When you read John chapter 6, you're not going to find pragmatism. Or you may find those in there that are using pragmatism. But I really think where this ends up, a pragmatist just can't handle John chapter 6. Because they would look at this and what? They all went away? He didn't give them what they wanted? And they count Jesus as a failure. Really? Are we ready for something like that? I don't think so. I don't think so at all. Well, the lesson is yours. Take your songbooks. Turn to the songs been selected. We ought to be concerned that truth is preached. I think that's the main thing. The truth is being preached. It's being taught. People are encouraged to practice it. And that the church is standing for truth. Those are two important things. Now, after that, God will take care of the numbers. He's the one that will give the increase. We should be Christians, we should live as Christians, and we should be encouraging others to do the same thing. Anything less is really just incidental. And a lot of times doesn't fit. And a lot of times it's just, the wrong thing. Pragmatism is one of those things that's just, it's just the wrong thing. That's not how it was done in New Testament times. That's not how Jesus did it. We shouldn't do it ourselves. The gospel message ends up with an earnest entreaty for those who believe in Jesus Christ to repent and to be baptized. And we do the same tonight. If you're subject to the gospel invitation, why don't you come all together? We stand and sing.